Does that sound good? Shall we just get going?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Okay, let's hit the theme song. Yet another episode of Shop Talk, the podcast about web design and development, where you ask the questions and we attempt to answer them, probably poorly or wrongly. I'm Dave Rupert, and I'm here with Chris Coyer.
Hi, peoples.
And we have a special guest, Zoe Gillenwater. Gillenwater or Gillenwater? I should have asked
the Gillenwater.
Gillenwater, Zoe Gillenwater. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
It is awesome to have you. Chris, why don't you tell our friends about Zoe?
I'd be glad to. I think I met Zoe one time, I think in at Converge, maybe, where you're speaking.
Yeah.
And did some stuff about responsive design and stuff, real project walkthrough thing, which is pretty cool. Zoe also has a couple of books on, like way back, December 2008, you had a book, Flexible Web Design, which is kind of, is kind of a highly praised book as far as like building websites that are, you know, use percentages for widths and, you know, kind of best practices and far that stuff. It's kind of like a big old thick book on that subject, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Cool. I was kind of surprised myself when I started writing it, how much you can write just about that one topic. Because it started out, just based on one article that I wrote. That's kind of where the idea came from. And then it turns out you can fill a whole
book
with it.
And this.
Yeah. And remember to do this. And then if you want to do this. Yeah. So, yeah.
Pretty cool. And it's kind of like I said in the tweet earlier this week, I'm like, this is kind of like, all that stuff is usable today. So it's 4 years later, and all that stuff matters just as much now, if not more, because more people are building flexible sites. And then you just add a couple of media queries, and you got responsive design, basically, right?
Yep.
So that would be the update to your book, if there was one, essentially.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all the other pieces are kind of there. You know, the flexible layout, and then flexible images within it, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, right. But the foundation's still a book worth picking up today. For sure, people, buy it.
Thank you.
Okay, I got my little show notes here. We're going to talk about some stuff. Not as much hot drama as there was last week. The vendor prefix thing is still firing on all cylinders on the web there, and it's getting pretty interesting. Maybe we'll do a follow-up on that later, but I think maybe we'll skip that drama for this week.
Yeah.
So in place of it, I always wanted to talk about just some stuff going on. You know, I do this. I have a full time job, and I work from home on Thursdays. And I'm sure everybody, you know, kind of is aware of us and what we do. But I work for the company SurveyMonkey and WooFoo. You know, SurveyMonkey bought WooFoo. I originally worked for WooFoo. We worked there. We're doing this cool thing. You know, it's nice that I'm able to do this during the day. So I just wanted to say thanks, shout out to them. They're kind of a sponsor of the show in that way. But we're doing this thing at WooFoo that we did last year called the Bar Camp Tour. So you can go check that out at barcamptour.com. It's where me and Kevin from WooFoo, and then Grasshopper Group and MailChimp and Batchbook and all these different companies send a person. We like go travel around to these bar camps and just like help them out and speak at them. And just, you know, we're not there as like brand shills or anything. We're just there to make brand camps better, or bar camps better. Anyway, I'm really excited about Bar Camp Tour. So if your city has a bar camp, you want all of us to come to it, you can apply at barcamptour.com. And I wanted to mention another couple of conferences. I'm going to be at LessConf this year in Atlanta, Georgia, just hanging out, not speaking. So if anybody's near Atlanta, Georgia, just Google LessConf. That's coming up pretty quick. Next week, or actually just yeah, not even, it's like Monday or something. I'm speaking at In Control in Orlando, Florida. That's going to, we got South by Southwest coming up. I'll be at that. And Dave lives there. So he kind of automatically goes to that.
Yeah, I live here. So if you guys want to have a party in my garage, we can do that. We'll make it happen. And just us, all of us hanging out in my garage. Should be fun. Should be fun.
Totally. Totally. Okay. And then, you know, so, and that's, you know, WooFoo lets me kind of go to those things too. And I worked on a couple of really fun things at WooFoo recently. If you go to woofoo.com/form builder, now you can like literally go to WooFoo and just start building a form and playing with it without even logging into an account. And so that was a project that I worked on recently that got released. That was pretty cool. And I think today we're pushing out literally the whole website is going to be in Spanish too. There's a little drop down. You change it to Spanish. The entire website's in Spanish. Now that was a monumental effort that I helped in some kind of parts of that. So anyway, I just wanted to share some stuff that I was working on in lieu of hot drama. So
hey, so you sent out a tweet that you use the box sizing, whatever border box. Is that right?
On with the universal selector. Yeah. Totally.
Run me through that. I'm curious. Did you hit any huge problems?
Have you seen this, though, where you, like, use the universal star selector and then you set box sizing border box or whatever?
Yeah, I saw Paul Irish posted about that. I've definitely used box sizing. I haven't tried, you know, just kind of using it with the universal selector yet. But you have tried that out, Chris?
Yeah, I've tried it on a couple of things. It's just... it's great. I don't know. There's so many situations that comes up, especially in, I think the most obvious use of it is something like a text area. Text areas are not 100% width, you know, like a div is or whatever, or just fill up the size of their parent container. Text areas just don't behave like that for whatever reason. And oftentimes you want them to. And so you go, okay, well, I guess I'll have to set width is 100% on it. But then you can't use pixel padding because then it will break out of that container, and it's super annoying. So text area is a great use for box sizing border box. So that's like where I use it the most. But then there's like, what about columns, doing column based layouts? I find it super convenient to use there too. Be like the, you know, I want 33%, 0.333 and 66 columns. And I just want to set those two things. And then I want to use padding within the column. Now you can just use that, use pixel padding inside it and not worry about it. So apparently there's a few issues with it or whatever. But yeah, but it's pretty deep browser support on it. And I just quite like using it. And just setting it on everything means you can just use it willy-nilly wherever you want. It's awesome. So anyway, I kind of recommend it. I have yet to be scorned by it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to start using it even more. Because yeah, it is really nice when you're doing anything that is flexible. I'm working on redesigning my site right now, and I've already started using it in quite a few places. So maybe I'll have to just kind of realize it's in too many places in my CSS, and I'll just have to stick it on a universal selector, you know, to keep things simpler. So we'll see if that ends up being the case.
Yeah, it seems like for flexible design, it would have huge strengths. Just, you know, sometimes you want it to be 30 pixels of padding, you know, and you just want
right.
to be strict yeah. about that. No,
that's a good point. What So said is like, you if you've you like look through your style sheet and see how many times you've explicitly said it, and then maybe that's your clue to use it on a wider selector. You know, like. I don't know. Anytime you see yourself repeating the same thing over and over and over, that's your cue to look at maybe possibly doing it a more efficient way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you wrote a post about that, didn't you, Chris? Just you're now starting to use the star selector on kind of lots of different stuff just because you're finding yourself using this stuff over and over and over.
Yeah. Now that post was more like, hey, let's start thinking about these things more than like, I'm doing this.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because I was a little worried hitting the button there. But what?
Oh, I was just saying we could probably, like, with all the stuff you've like written about in the last week, make this like the complete CSS Tricks podcast.
Yeah.
You have a lot of going on at your blog. But Like, so everyone should go check it out if they don't already. I don't really know why they're here. But but yeah, no, that was sort of tied into the star box sizing stuff. So, yeah. I was just interested. This was me asking the first question. I do have another question, if you guys are interested. So last week, we had Jeffrey Way of Envato on the show, and I just was, you know, talking to him, and he said, you know, everyone at Envato, you know, in high school went to detention a lot. And do you guys know why they went to detention a lot? Because they released so many toots. Get it?
Tutorials.
Tutorials. Hold on.
Dumb with a U.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yes. We can't let a week go by, can we, folks? Nope.
Nope. Keep them coming. All right.
We're going to roll our way into the question and answer portion.
Okay.
Shop Talk Show.
The first question is from Anthony Garand, and it's about print style sheets.
Hey guys, I'm Anthony Garand. A few days ago, I saw a tweet by Chris saying that he had just gotten his print style sheets put together for CSS Tricks. With all the digital devices around us today, I find it hard to believe that there are still that many people printing out websites. Which sparked a question. Would it be possible to track how often a print style sheet is being used? Is it really important to include it in a website these days? Also, how would you go about getting analytics for this? Chris, you mentioned tracking the keyup event on Command-P keypress. Would it also be possible to track HTTP requests for individual files on a server? And as far as accessibility, do screen readers look for a print style sheet? Thanks.
Well, there you go. So, Chris, you did a print style sheet. Tell us your reasoning.
Well, it's just one of those things that I think you should do, especially on a tutorial site like that where, you know, once in a while, even if people aren't hitting it to paper, maybe they want to, like, print it to a PDF and send to somebody or something. I don't know. That would be weird. I'm not sure. It's just one of those things that you can do, so why not do a good job with it and let it just, like, you know, if you just were to print CSS Tricks without it, you'd get ads. You know, the formatting would be a disaster. You know, it's just like, why not just spend a few minutes to take a print style sheet, hide a bunch of garbage, like hide the whole sidebar, hide the header, hide the footer, make sure the widths are right, pick a font that looks good in print, and be done with it. It doesn't take that long. So, Zoe, how often do you worry about it in your day-to-day work? Do you spend any time on print style sheets?
I pretty much always include a print style sheet, but yeah, I don't put a lot of effort into it, but I definitely, you know, suppress printing, ads, navigation, and just kind of make sure that things are full width, you know, so that whatever size paper somebody's printing on, it'll, you know, scale to fit. And, you know, you don't have to have a separate style sheet. If you're concerned about having an extra HTTP request, you could use the app media rule inside your main style sheet to just drop in a few print-related rules inside there. And, you know, so that might kind of take care of one concern that some people would have with having a print style sheet.
That's exactly how I do it, too. Just, you know how people are, you know, this is funny that we live in a day where I'm pretty sure more people are familiar with at media queries than are worried about print, just because it's just not right in the, like, public thinking. But you know how at media queries work, right? It's like at media, and then you put some parentheses, and you put some stuff in the parentheses, and then brackets, and then you put all your CSS that you want for the media query in those brackets. That's how it works with print, too. You just go at media print, and then the braces, and you put anything that you want specifically to style for print in there. And I would say, how I do it is I also do a media screen for all the stuff above it so that none of that screen styling makes its way into the print styling. I approach print styling completely fresh, you know, with no CSS applied at all.
Yeah, and I usually do the opposite. I usually have my main styles applied to print and screen just because I find like I'm often then redeclaring, you know, fonts or something like that. So, I mean, I think, you know, either way, it kind of depends on which site results in more CSS, depending on how many of the rules you're going to be reusing in the print style sheet. But yeah, anyway.
I agree. It just depends, and it's kind of just a personal style kind of thing. A lot of people here are saying that you could use, if you wanted to make it like an external style sheet, or even if you use a preprocessor and can kind of reuse different bits here and there, to use your print style sheet as your browser fallback style sheet. You know, if you're one of those people who's just like serving a minimal style sheet to IE6 and 7 or whatever, like again, like I do on CS Tricks, that you could reuse your print style sheet for that purpose, which I think is perfectly good idea.
Yeah.
So, and then Anthony's question was about tracking it too, to figure out if it's kind of worth it, maybe to worry about print at all. So, like, can we figure out? Is there a technological way that we can figure out how many people are printing our websites? And just while we were talking on Twitter, I was like, maybe there's some way that you could, like, through JavaScript, watch for people hitting Command P. Like, maybe, like, that's not the only way you could do it. So, that wouldn't be entirely accurate. But I wonder if we could brainstorm some ways where we could track that. And another thing, I just like Anthony mentioned, like, is there a way where you could put like an, you know how if you put an image that only shows up in a certain media query into your CSS, it literally won't load that image unless it's being used. So I guess the deal is like if you hit print, then only then will the browser request that image. So then you could look through your server logs and see how many times that image has been requested, and that's how many times your thing has been printed. I'm not sure if that's 100% foolproof either, but I guess that's a possibility. So. Okay, so that's I would be interested. Anthony, if you learn any more about tracking print usage, that would be interesting. I didn't even get a chance to Google it, really. If anybody else knows about how we can accurately find out how many people are printing our websites, we'll do a quick follow-up on it. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And then there was also a question about accessibility in terms of print style sheets, if screen readers request the print style sheets. And not that I know. I don't think that any screen readers do anything with print style sheets. Screen readers definitely do pay attention to CSS because, you know, display none and hiding things off left and different things can affect what they read. So there are cases where screen readers pay attention to CSS, but I've never heard of a screen reader paying attention to a print style sheet or that being something that impacts, you know, what gets read and what the accessibility of a page is. So no concerns there, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. There's a bunch of, like, just standard print style sheet tricks. Like we mentioned, just display none on a bunch of stuff that you just don't want to print. There's the one where you can use a pseudo element to grab the URL of links and apply it on the page. That way you can, you know, see the link. Because a blue underline is pretty useless in a print document. It would be nice to see the URL. There's ones like if you have comments, like in CSS Tricks, people may or may not want to print the comments. So just using the, you know, like dot comments is the selector where my comments start. Doing page break before always, and that way if people, you know, print, they can get a clean break between the articles and the comments and just only choose to print a few pages or whatever. Those are just general tips. That's not what Anthony was asking anyway, but just some tips for the world.
I'm going to have to go to your site and try printing it now, Chris, and see how it comes out.
Oh. I'm scared. We'll see how it goes. Okay, let's move on.
Bought the domain name printstylesheettricks.com. So
I bet there's room for a mini jQuery plugin in here. I really do, Dave.
I could probably work that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're gonna find your niche.
Yeah. Tiny jQuery print plugin. Okay, let's go to the next question.
Fit Michael. Print, not JS. Fit, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Ideas are just rolling.
Hello, gentlemen. This is Michael calling from Sin City, Nevada. I have a question for you concerning how you prefer to organize the declarations within your CSS files. Specifically, do you prefer placing each declaration on its own line in the file, or do you prefer combining all the declarations for a particular declaration block on a single line? I have tried both approaches, and I find advantages and disadvantages to each one. In the case of placing each declaration on its own line, which seems to be the most common approach. It makes it easier to spot the property names, and it's also much faster to alphabetize those properties, especially using one's editor's built-in sorting capability. On the other hand, it makes the CSS files much longer, causing one to have to page up and down a lot more. So I'm wondering what your preferences are, if any, and what your thoughts are as to the advantages and disadvantages of each one. Thanks.
Well, there we go. That's the single line versus multi-line CSS, a age-old debate.
It really is one. I've talked about it a little bit. How do you roll, Zoe? Do you do the selector and then the brace and then return and each property on the line?
Be honest, this is a judgment zone. This is a complete judgment zone.
Oh, no, I better answer the right way. I actually go back and forth myself. So that's probably not the cleanest way to do things. But I feel like, okay, for the longest time, I always had each declaration on its own line. And then, I don't know, one of the disadvantages of that is, like the caller, I forget what his name was, said, you know, it makes things really long, and that can take a while then to find the rule that you're looking for. And so I started sometimes putting things all in one line if the rule was rather short, you know, if there was like, you know, five or less declarations in there. So I kind of mixed the two. I don't think my CSS looks that messy, even having them mixed a little bit. But I tend to use having each declaration on its own line more often. I think it's just kind of habit. But yeah, there, I can see the advantages of doing it the other way, too.
Yeah, we may just end up with the fact that there's just no super good answer to this question. I totally have flipped back and forth. These days, I'll have to say, in the last year or something, I've done pretty much the multi. I hate the word multi-line. It's always multi-line. You know, you don't write your CSS literally in one line. But multi-line just meaning the selector, and then each property and value is on a new line for whatever. I think it started when CSS 3 became a bigger deal and you had to do vendor prefixes. That got ridiculous to list all those out in one line.
Right,
but yeah. I used to like it. I still like pine for those days where my style sheets were like taking up the whole screen and I could browse the selectors really easily. These days I'm mostly command F in my thing and just look for the selector I'm looking for and jump over there quick. And now I'm on preprocessors, so now the CSS 3 stuff is kind of gone anyway, so maybe I'll go back. I don't know. But ultimately, like, what if your argument is, oh, it uses less white space or something like that using the single line formatting, that's just garbage because you should be compressing your style sheets for production anyway. So it really doesn't matter how you write CSS is. Anyway, Dave, how do you weigh in?
So I have like I do both. Like, it ends up being both, you know, like, just you get lazy and you're just like, I'm just gonna fix this, you know. But if it's just one rule, I'll put it on the same line, like a color adjustment or something like that. But if it's more than one, you break it out on separate lines, and I alphabetize, which is kind of another thing I guess we could add into this mix, is should you alphabetize your properties or not? You know, vendor prefixes you have to like keep in a special order, you know, a sacred order, but
that's
yeah,
true.
Man. But I totally alphabetize, because how many times have you like gone into something and you're working and you change like the width? You know, you like add in width, you know, and you're just like, the width's not changing. What's going on? Well, it's because it's got like three other width declarations in the same one line.
Never,
you know?
Dave, that's never happened to me.
Never happened ever. You must be better at CSS than me. Yeah, you know, just maybe not three times, but like there's a one other one that's already, you know, there. Yes, but
that did happen to me yesterday, actually. I can see that. Although I have to say I do not alphabetize my properties. That's okay though. I think it's cool.
No,
I don't alphabetize. I have this set order that I kind of do them in, and my brain like cannot handle the alphabetical order. I just can't handle it. It's just not the way my brain works. So I have to have like, I do positioning stuff first, and then I do like display stuff, and then I do all the box model. It goes width, height, margin, padding, border, background color, and then I do all the text stuff. And so, yeah, that's
your
order. I don't know. That's just how I do it. And it's what I'm used to. And I have to kind of start out broad and then work inward kind of is how it seems to, how I kind of visualize it. But that's me. I'm not saying people should do that. I'm just saying that's what I do.
We're definitely not going to throw out an official recommendation here. It's just kind of fun.
I am
talk
official.
Shop.
I am official about alphabetical. I had a friend. He's Adam McCullough. He's now at Facebook, but he was very strict, very stern with me. Alphabetize it. Just do it. Don't be a douche, I think was my thing. But so now, ever since then, every time I write CSS, I just hear him in the back of my head going, alphabetize it. Just do it. So. He doesn't sound
like
that.
I was
going
to apply douche to any category. I would say it would be on the person demanding that you alphabetize, but hey, that's just me. You should look at a post. Jeff's, no offense to Captain
You're
Facebook.
Fine, you're fine. He can take it.
Jeff Starr, my co-author on the book Digging into WordPress, who runs perishablepress.com, has some crazy posts on like the most anal retentive possible ways you can write a CSS. You know, all the crazy formatting you can do. You know, like just I'll link it up in the show notes because it is epic. How
it's a good read. Maybe you should just pull it up and read
it's
it.
It's an awful
right
read.
Now.
I can't even read it. I can't. If I end up on that link, I have to close it because it just.
Oh, you're just like cringing?
No, it's great. It's a great read if you're into that stuff, but I just can't be that about formatting stuff. Okay, that's a long thing. Yeah, longest word first. Like or organizing them in the order of how long the declaration is. Oh my god.
Whoa.
So it looks pretty, or pretty
cool. Yeah, it looks cool. Okay, let's move on though. We got Chase Woodford. Thanks for your question, Chase. He said he saw this, and this is a link to the new W3, the development specs for CSS variables. He said he saw that the other day, and he was a little confused. He said it looks like SAS/less variables in the form of CSS data properties. Any thoughts on this proposal? How does it stack up to SAS/less from what you've experienced so far? I'm on the fence about going steady with less. I think I should I hold out to make the leap anyways? Thanks for in advance for the tip, bro. Yes. Have you seen it, these you guys?
The variable? I haven't, so I can't really comment.
I have.
It,
there was a bit of a, I guess it was last summer, a web developer at Chrome just kind of built this variable implementation and wrote a spec for it. And I think it was supposed to like make its way into the browser, but that's probably slowed down smartly. But, in the like beta Chromes, but it's basically, it's a very SAS like syntax, I believe, where you declare at var, my var name, and then you assign the value. So you can do at var pink and it's the dribble pink hex color, you know, for example. So I don't know if, I hope it comes in. I think CSS needs to be smarter eventually, but I think SAS is probably the way forward in this or less. I use those interchangeably, but I think SAS is probably the way forward just because you'll have the backwards compatibility. You'll have the forward, you know, you could in theory have forwards compatibility because the preprocessor is doing the work. So that I think go steady with SAS, man. Commit. Pop the question.
We're going to try and I really want to be careful about Because I'm just, like, so excited about pre-processes lately, and I used to be, like, not against them, but just, like, annoyed with people that used them a ton, and it was, like, so I feel like let's try to, I'm going to attempt to not make this, like, the SAS show or whatever, because CSS is a bigger place than that. There's more to talk about, and I don't really give it if you use one or not, honestly. Oh, Dad, I swear, I really don't want a bad rating. I have to bleep that. do you use pre-processor just real quick? Have you ever...
No.
It doesn't matter. Zoe is an incredibly good CSS person, and I don't care if she uses one or not. It doesn't matter.
Thank you.
Okay. But the variables thing is pretty interesting. I like how they modeled the spec after data, which it reminds me of how jQuery handles data. You just set an element and you give it a bit of arbitrary data or whatever. It kind of mimics that API. Because I think the CSS variables is going to match. There's going to be JavaScript APIs that work with it, you know, and you kind of set it and stuff in the same kind of ways that jQuery can do it. So I think that was a smart model because that's a nice way. Anyway. I don't know. The question was kind of like, should I wait for this? No, you shouldn't. If you really want to use CSS variables, don't wait. It has no implementations in any browser. It's going to be forever before you can reliably use them. If you want to reliably use them, you're going to have to use SAS forever for like 10 years, probably, you know, really long time. So, don't wait if you're into it, but it's good that the spec is pressing on with stuff like this. Certainly.
Definitely cool. Well, okay, let's move on, shall we? The next question is from John Lind. He's asking, what do you guys think of using Glyph web fonts such as Pictos as icons? Are there performance issues? It seems to be a nice alternative to SVG. I will go on record and say I love UI web fonts, but they have some problems. Kind of.
I'm pretty into it. I mean, I think we're, you know, and we use them all over Wufoo now. We've switched over to using Pictos and in the design patterns I'm building for SurveyMonkey, we're using Pictos. I'm using them on another new project. I think, and now there's this new service called Pictos Server. This is from Drew Wilson who puts this out. And it's kind of like a design your own Pictos. Now, one of the problems with web fonts might be that you have to load up this at font face icon to use it. And instead of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, whatever, they're like up arrow, down arrow, stack of papers. You know what I mean? And then to use that icon, you just use like A and it's a stack of paper. So one of the concerns is that a screen reader will read A, and that's weird because that's not what you meant. You meant stack of papers or whatever. But John is asking about performance issues. I don't know. I mean, if you're loading up one at font face resource versus if you didn't sprite your glyphs or icons or whatever and you loaded up 50 glyphs on your page, that would be way worse than using just loading up one resource that's a font. So depending on how you do it, but if you just have a little tiny sprite, that might actually be more efficient than a web font, which can have fairly large file sizes unless you use Pictos Server, which lets you design your own. And there's just a million things to think about here. And John is like, it seems to be a nice alternative to SVG. I would think SVG would be the alternative at this point. I've never used SVG for icons, even though I've seen some cool resources on doing it, but I've never actually dug in there. So, have you ever used icon font, though?
Yeah. And my kind of main concern is accessibility. You know, having the character that is, you know, behind that icon announced by a screen reader. Because, I mean, that's kind of my other thing. I'm a CSS person, but I'm also an accessibility person, and actually accessibility is what I'm doing full-time right now at AT&T. And so, you know, I do a lot of testing in screen readers, and so that's definitely a concern. There are, you know, some kind of workarounds. There's a good write-up on the Filament Group's website. Scott, I don't know how you say his last name. Scott Gell. Gell. He's a smart guy. He always says interesting stuff to suggest. So, I mean, there's you know some kind of workarounds there, but that's kind of my main hesitation with making, you know, broad use of those.
Yeah, so that's a pretty common like concern, and it's a super valid concern, and it's one of the ones that people have been trying to fight against. One of them is, well, okay, just apply the icon with a pseudo element, and on most screen readers, pseudo elements aren't read because they are not a part of the DOM, and that's in
yeah.
the screen reader gets part of the part of the. You know, reads from the DOM. And then it turns out with more research that for whatever reason, OS X's VoiceOver, which I'm not sure what the market share of that in screen readers is, but I'm sure some people use it, does read it. So that is a problem. And then it was found out later that if you, instead of using a pseudo element, just use a span for that thing, you can then set this like, the, what is WRIA?
Y area or what?
Yeah, and then just literally tell it, don't speak this.
Right, right.
And it will not yeah. speak it.
Yeah, I think if you're using them for just kind of decorative stuff, then that's fine. Yeah, and you're able to hide them from a screen reader. You know, where I wouldn't want to use them is if you had like a shopping cart icon with no text, you know.
Right, and it was literally your add to cart button.
Right, yeah. I mean, that would be a problem. You know, but yeah, if you're using them as an icon next to text or as just kind of a decoration sort of thing, then sure. I think, like you said, Chris, they can be more efficient than using images in many cases. You know, if you're replacing a lot of different images with just the one font, so yeah, I like them. I definitely make use of yeah. them sometimes. So.
It does need to be thought about in deeper. I think somebody ought to, somebody might say, well, okay, if you're going to use it as a button that only replaces it with the screen reader, then you would, you know, put add to cart in the text, and then you would make it display inline box, and you would overflow hidden, and you would kick
right.
the text off the thing. Like, there's ways to handle
yeah.
all this stuff, but it really isn't. You gotta sweat the details when using this thing because it can
right.
be an accessibility problem. You know, and if people, you know, like, why would you? I'm sure there's a few people out there that are using icons as fonts or fonts as icons. This is so weird to me. It is cool and it is worth looking at. And the reason is all that, like, because the fonts are vector, you know how you can increase the size of a text on the website by just, you know, changing the font size. You can do that same thing with an icon, too. So it's really easy to change the size of them without losing the quality, which is not possible with an image, of course. It is possible with SGBG, but let's just save that. And you can change the color and you can apply shadows to them. And it's just kind of, they're easier to use. So anyway, they're pretty
yeah.
cool. I'll put some links into the show notes as to why you might want to use it, and then some links to some articles that cover the concerns with using them too. So let's move on to the next one. What do you got, Dave?
Let's see. So we got a question here from Matt Edwards. And Matt wrote in asking, I've got some questions about header logos and responsive design. Normally the logo would be in a markup like header, H1, logo, H1, header, but it's easier to have the image resize with header, H1, logo, close the H1, image, source logo, header. Are you guys following me? Is there a better way? Is what I'm doing terrible for some reason that I haven't noticed yet? So he, I guess, would normally do like an image replacement on the H1, but now he's doing just probably hiding the H1 and using an image in the header as a logo.
Yes, that's a good way to sum that up. So, you know, just like we talked about with icon fonts, with the logo, he's talking about, you know, setting a fixed width and height and setting overflow hidden and doing negative text indent to kick the logo off the page and replacing that with an image. And he's saying, well, that's in responsive design. If that logo is a graphic, it can be a little hard. Whereas if you just have an inline image tag, you can mess with the width and the height. You can do the max width 100% thing. And in a fluid layout, you could get that logo to shrink if you needed to. And that's easier to do, he's saying, by putting an image tag right in there and then hiding the text on the H1, but having the image tag still be in there. That's interesting stuff. And I read this guy's question the other day and I was like, opened up JS Fiddle and I was like, yeah, but you can do background size 100% auto. And that way, if the container shrinks, the background size of that image, shrinks down. And that's not supported in IE8. but if you didn't, if you for whatever reason weren't covering IE8, that could be possible. So do you have any experience with that type of, you know what he's talking about?
The
sizing background images?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems like for now, I mean, using background size is the main way to go, like you were talking about. And if you're not having your responsive design like show to IE8, and you know you can just feed it at one static logo image, then that's not really a problem that it doesn't support the background size either. Mm-hmm. You know, because it won't see this. Yeah. If it's not seeing the scaling page, then it doesn't matter if it's not seeing the scaling logo. So, you know, I think that can work in a lot of situations.
I like it too. And then there's always background size cover too. So anyway, where I was going with this is that I posted that because I was like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to play with this. So Matt Edwards here has a good answer to his question. And then on the same day, Elliot J. Stocks is like, oh, I had this problem in a responsive design environment and I needed a fix for it. And I had a friend. I'm really sorry. I should have looked up the guy who built this jQuery plugin for him, but it's called like auto cover or something like that. And it's this jQuery plugin that basically deals with resizing background images for him better. But the way that it does it, it doesn't just shrink it exactly to scale. It'll like chop off some of the tops or left or whatever, but also resize it a little bit. And, you know, it's a nice solution for responsive background images. And then that reminded me of background size cover, which is kind of a way to kind of do the same thing, but it has even less support. Anyway. There's ways to do it. I think what you're doing, Matt, of just putting the image in there, not a big deal. I would, you know, like if that it's okay as long as you don't have alt text in there that also says logo, so you're repeating the text twice. But look into other solutions too. Look into the background size thing I posted. Look into Elliot's post. Look into background size hover. And then if you just, you know, if you aren't doing the responsive thing for IE8, like Zoe said, oh, screw it, then definitely use background size.
Yeah.
Interesting question, though. I like that type of stuff. That's a valid question in today's responsive world. Okay, we got... Remember last week we were talking about the HTML CSS book by John Duckett? I'm going to say, you know, I use my little random number generator on people that submitted an audio question this week. One was from Keith Weiland, which we're not going to do your question this week, Keith, but it is in the queue and we'll do it. Thanks for sending that in, Keith Weiland. You have won the HTML CSS book, and we have two more of them. Yeah. I want to blow up a little party horn.
Oh shoot. I'm overzealous.
We're going to give away two more of these things. Really nice, really nicely designed and written book. So check that out. If you want, we're just going to keep the thing the same. You want to win the HTML and CSS book, submit an audio question of any kind and we will enter you for the winning next week. So congratulations, Keith. I also have a new little giveaway thing that we're going to do. There's an app called Processor. It's spelled P-R-O-C-S-S-O-R, Processor, and it's basically a Mac OS X app. So sorry, Windows, Linux folks, whatever. It only works on that. But it's this really nice looking GUI app for like doing the compression and stuff of in different formatting and stuff of your CSS. So if you're not using a preprocessor, but you want to like, you know, deploy compressed CSS, you can drop it into this app and it will do that stuff for you according to your options. It's a really nice looking app. We have some promo codes for that. So we'll probably just do random winners kind of thing. I don't have a good contest idea. What's a good contest idea? Should we do a Twitter-related or something?
Yeah, tell your friends about Shop Talk. If you tell your friend about Shop Talk...
And we see your at reply. Anybody who at replies Shop Talk show, literally that, on Twitter this week, you'll be one of the winners. And we have five to give away. But we'll do it over the course of a couple weeks. This week, we'll pick two winners.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty cool. Thanks for giving that away. Oh, you know, we won't cover our apps. We don't have any official sponsors this week, which is sad face, but that's you know, if you want to hit us up, shoptalkshow/advertising, and we'll do it. But those are our pseudo-advertisers this week. We'll do giveaways. Give you a reason to listen to this stuff. Okay, we have some questions about CSS animations. A couple of people have, so we're going to play two audio questions back-to-back, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay, here we go.
Hey guys, my name is Blake, and I'm over here in Utah. I've got a question for you about CSS3 transitions. Actually, two questions. First one is Is it a bad idea to use all, as in transitioning all properties? So transition all 1 second ease. Is that a bad idea, or do I need to say the specific property like color, whatever? And then the second question is how to handle writing the CSS for transitions on a huge project that has, you know, multiple style sheets, each one having hundreds of lines of code and many elements that are transitioned. So you're potentially repeating the transition code with the vendor prefixes a bunch of times. So you could do it that way, just on each rule that needs it, or you could pile on the selectors into one rule, so all the elements comma separated, and then all that rule does is add, you know, WebKit transition, Mohs transition, O transition, and then transition, and then it just puts all, and then the timing in that. Or the third way is to maybe make a class called transition. Would that be a bad idea? And then any element that you added the class to, it would just, the only thing that that CSS rule does is add the transition and all in the timing. So thank you for taking my question. Love to hear your thoughts about this. See ya.
Okay, that was question one from Blake Johnson. We're going to move on to
this is just a more generic version of the same kind of question.
Hi, my name is David. I'm French, so I'm sorry for my poor English speaking. I'm quite fond of CSS animations, and I would have loved you to speak about all the new animations we can make with the mix of HTML5 and CSS animations. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, lots to talk about there. CSS transitions and animations. And David just gave us a slew of options about how you might approach doing it in a style sheet. Kind of, you know, like a standard way, and then like some, maybe possibly some object-oriented kind of ways I think he's hinting at there. But one of the questions was just about using all versus, like, if you just want to animate the color or something like that. He's wondering, I think he was basically asking, this was Blake, right, if there was any performance concerns. Have you found that to be the case, Zoe?
I haven't, but I haven't, you know, he was talking about using it on a really big site, and I really haven't had experience with using it on a really big site. I mean, certainly not using all or anything. So I can't really speak from experience whether that would cause a problem
or
not.
Me either, really.
I haven't seen that, but I don't know.
I mean, I would assume that it's the case. You know, your browser has to do more work if you want to transition your padding and your margin and your color and your, you know, anything that's like number or color based. Basically, you can transition. If the browser has to transition more of those, it's a little bit harder of work for it. Now, how hard are you going to notice the browser chug when you do it? I don't know, but you might want to think about how it behaves on mobile. You might want to like try out a Chromebook or something with like 500 megabytes of RAM or whatever on that, and see, like, of course your desktop Hummer machine is gonna not have a problem with it, but you might want to try a browser that has less juice to it and give it a shot. I just in that star selector post that Dave mentioned earlier on CSS Tricks, I was like, maybe we should try a star selector with all the vendor prefix transition 0.2 seconds ease, and not only, you know, not only use all, but use it on all elements. So, you know, and I tried it on a few sites. I just like injected that CSS and I'm like, ooh, this is kind of nice. You know, like everything that you do has a little bit of smoothness, a little softness to it. You know, it was kind of nice. And of course, my MacBook Pro that's kind of loaded up had no problems with it, but I'm not sure. Like I said in the article, I was like, I'm not going to officially recommend that you start doing this, you know. And some people's arguments against it were just like, well, for one thing, sometimes you just want things to be more instantaneous. It just feels snappier. So there's some design considerations there. Ooh, laptop. And performance is an issue too. I can't speak to performance. Like Zoe said, I haven't worked on a huge, huge site that just has like, you know, that's just like super deep or super complicated or using super tons and tons and tons of CSS3. There may be some issues there. Dave, performance, do you have thoughts?
I'm making a huge assumption, but yeah, if you have more properties, you're going to basically ask your computer to do more things. So I've gotten into pickles where I do, like, you know, transition all on all my links because I want that sexy fade in effect, you know. But then you get into like a button where things just start transit, you know, then it maybe it starts transitioning weird. Maybe there's some opacity and but you want more of an instant reaction. So I just started being pretty specific, I think, is how I overcame it. I guess I use all just to get the animation working, and then I figure out what I want to do with that. But I will then use just color or something like that. Because you can't really, like, animate background images too well. You can't animate a few things. You know, there's various properties that you can't animate, and so you'll kind of get frustrated if you have the all. And so your timing starts looking all weird.
That's a good point, though, to use all as kind of, you know, when you're developing the site to see how things look transitioning and decide, like, which ones you want to actually transition. I like that idea.
I do, too. That's smart. Start, you know, just do it all and then trim back, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of what we do at Paravel. We'll just all it, and then if it gets weird, you just be explicit, like color. But if you're going the explicit route, it'll beef up your CSS about 50-fold. So, you know, use transitions and animations sparingly. So, or else you'll have a maintainability problem.
All right. Well, I think we got time for one more. Maybe if we cruise, we can do two more. But then we're going to have to sadly call it a close for this week again. I got one from Josh Johnson here. He says, doesn't it seem like there should be a shorthand text property? There already is one for font, right? So font, you go bold, space, 12 pixels, space, sans serif, you know, or whatever. And then it will apply font weight, bold, font size, 12 pixels, font family, sans serif, kind of, that's the shorthand for font. But why not have this for, you know, for text, decoration, text align, text transform, all that type of thing? Have you thought about that, guys? Can you speculate as to why we don't have that?
I've never really thought about that before. I don't see why we shouldn't be able to have it, because I don't know. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I think it would be useful too, because anything that makes our CSS more succinct is a good thing, I think. And I think the reason is, and I could be wrong, I'm speculating here, is that I think all those three probably share properties like inherit, whereas some of the other ones don't. And I think, so if you, I think in the theory in shorthand is that there needs to be a way that they force the order of how you do it. And they try to not force you a lot. They try and have be, and so, you know, have you tried with box shadow, like box shadow inset? You can put inset anywhere you want in there and it will work pretty much. You can put it at the end, the beginning, whatever. So if if you wrote text, inherit bold or something, or underline or something, I don't know. I think there's just too many shared possibilities. I explained that awfully, but I bet that's why we don't have it, is that the order would be too important. And that's just not ideal for shorthand.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's actually kind of part of the reason why I don't use the font shorthand very often. I use all the other ones, but the font shorthand, that one is one that where it, like, if you leave bold out, for instance, or you don't say normal, then it's, you know, it's
it
going
doesn't
to
work.
Yeah.
It just doesn't
so,
work.
That one is kind of more picky about what you include in it, as opposed to like the background shorthand where you can just include whichever pieces you want and whichever order you want. That kind of makes sense, Chris, that it would be kind of a little bit too, I don't know, stringent about what needs to be in there and in what order. But
we're not sure, but maybe somebody who's maybe smarter will tell us exactly why we don't have that. Or maybe there it's just no good reason. I don't know. Let's do one more. It's only 56. Let's do a really quick one from Billy Brown, 16-year-old. Listen to the show. We got a lot of young folks listening. I love it.
Okay, here we go, Billy Brown.
Do we still need to use conditional style sheets now that IE has a update notification system? And how many different kinds of style sheets is it usually good to have per website if we don't know the exact traffic we're going to have from where? Thank you.
Take it, Zoe.
I love the thing that Paul Irish kind of put out there, I don't know, a year or so ago about having the different classes for the different versions of Internet Explorer on your HTML tag. And so you can target different versions of IE that way. I think there are still a few times, even though, you know, yeah, lots of people are going to be upgrading IE, but there's still going to be, you know, some group of people that aren't upgraded. And while I certainly don't care about making the site pretty for them necessarily, they should still be able to, you know, use the site. And so I still feed IE rules to older versions occasionally, and having those classes is just a really easy way to do it instead of having to worry about conditional comments and separate style sheets and extra HTTP requests and all that. So that is my current thinking. And
I agree. I think that's pretty smart. Now, you might need conditional tags to load like an HTML5 shim, for example, because that's not going to help you otherwise. But yeah, I don't know. They're both okay ways. But yeah, I mean, if you're just doing a few little tweaks, definitely the HTML5 boilerplate kind of way of adding the classes to the thing. And you know what? It gives you this big block, right, in the HTML5 boilerplate that's like IE6, IE7, IE8, IE9. You can, if you want, simplify. If you're not supporting IE6 and 7 at all, get rid of those two. Or if you just want IE8 and down, make just one of them and put old IE in there, which is oldie, which I like that class name. How do you handle it, Dave?
We usually do one like IE8 and down style sheet. We try to not do any IE8 style sheets. I mean, we're that good. We don't ever know. But we try not to. And then we just do an IE8 down. And that will basically sort, you know, any problem that 8 has, it probably exists in 7. And it probably for surely existed in 6. So usually you can just wipe those out together. And you're serving all those IEs kind of the same. You know, sometimes you have to kind of be aggressive and just like completely rip out stuff just to make it work, you know, non-consequential stuff. But yeah, that's sort of what we do. Yeah, that's how it works.
There you go, Billy. Using them is okay. But if you can get avoid the HTTP request. Awesome. Anyway, thanks so much, Zoe, for being on the show. That was really cool. You're a smart cookie.
Thanks.
What about following? What about what do you want?
Yeah, how can people give you money?
Well, my website and my Twitter handle are Zomigi, ZOMIGI.com. And so you can go there, and I have links to both my books, Stunning CSS3 and Flexible Web Design. And there's, you know, free excerpts and everything that you can download on their associated sites. But yeah, I've really enjoyed talking with you guys, geeking out about CSS stuff. So thanks for having me on.
I just got it. It's the first two letters of your first, middle, and last name, right?
It is. Yep, exactly right.
Wow. It took me a long time to get that.
I like doing that to people's names. Sometimes it forms cool words, so I thought it worked well on my name.
Oh my God, I'm never going to be able to stop getting that out of my head now.
And it's cool that it has OMG in it.
Deru?
Yeah, it would be Deru. Which is actually my World of Warcraft name. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Let's wrap it up, Chris.
Shop.show.com.